Hi, my name is Nancy Bell, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I have the joyful privilege of introducing Corinne. I've gotten to talk to her a few times, and I'm impressed by her resourcefulness, her resilience in having survived being at Ground Zero and going through the earthquake. Her stories of watching her underwear go past her window, and I'm just thinking, my underwear was in my drawer, and I still couldn't get packed. I don't know how she did it. Another thing that's impressed me about Corinne is her total commitment to this program of recovery. We in Al-Anon owe a lot to the program of AA. You've given us three legacies, and I cherish them like jewels. The first legacy is personal recovery through the steps. And we took those steps word for word from you. We only changed one word in the 12th step. We changed the word alcoholics to others. And it's meant personal recovery for me. Our second legacy from you is unity through the tradition. And I believe that we have Al-Anon AA today because of those traditions. Our third legacy is service through the concept. And Corinne has struck me as someone very committed to service. And so I'm going to read to you two sentences from our to the concept in our Al-Anon Alateen Service Manual. Carrying the message, as suggested in the 12th step, is service, Al-Anon's third legacy. Service, a vital purpose of Al-Anon, is action. Members strive to do as well as to be. I want you to help me welcome Corinne, who does that very thing. She demonstrates that our freedom to serve is truly the freedom by which we live and have our being.
Hi, everybody. My name's Corinne Elrod, and I'm a very grateful, imperfect member of Al-Anon. And I'm really glad to be here, and I have to say that I'm imperfect because then I can remember why I'm here. I came to this fellowship, you know, and I was perfect. I was just wrapped right, and everything was great, and you guys just screwed me up. I don't know what happened. But I got to find out about me, and, you know, it's just a miracle to be here. I mean, it's just a miracle to be any place for me, but it's a miracle to be here in Minnesota. I looked out the window this morning and I saw this green in this flat. You know, it's so different than California. You guys don't have any palm trees. And it's just beautiful here. And I don't know how somebody like myself can be at a conference of alcoholics and Al-Anon and Alateens and feel like you're a part of my family and feel comfortable from where I came from. It's just a miracle to me. I wrote down some notes this morning because I get so wound up, I forget who to thank, and then I forget their names, and then I feel stupid because I've forgotten their names. So I wrote the names down so I could remember, and I really want to thank Betty because she's called me several times. We are sponsored, we're in the same sponsorship chain. And I got to meet her when my sponsor was celebrating her 25th anniversary, and we gave her a great big party, and it was so fun. And she came out to California, and that was neat. And she's just been wonderful and loving to me here. And Dick has given us letters. We got these great letters, you know, and when the earthquake happened, shortly thereafter, we got a letter from him, and it was really terrific. And it's just a great place to see people coming together. I said to my sponsor, I said, I understand they have closed-circuit television. And she said, yes, they do. I said, I'm speaking at 9:30 in the morning. She said, yes. I said, people could be in bed watching me. Things could be going on. She said, yes, they could. And if they are, trust me, they're not listening to you. So, for all of you that are in bed, hi. I said that to my husband, and my husband said, tell them to keep their hands above the sheets. Well, I don't know what that means. But, you know, And so I left this on my little note, you know, I left it on the nightstand type of thing. And I went into the restroom, and when I came out to leave, I went to pick it up, and at the bottom of it, it says, "Hubby, for understanding and for being so loving." So I want to thank my husband for his understanding and for being so loving. Thanks, honey. Oh, boy, you know. the theme of your conference here, of the conference Came to Believe, is really kind of special to me. I was meditating on it, and I thought, you know, one of the things that's happened to me is I believe that there's a God. I have always believed that there was a God. I have always had a faith in a God. My only problem was I really believe he's going to do it for you. I'm not really sure what he's going to do for me. And that has been a process for me of learning how to trust. And what I'm going to share with you today is my story, and it's the only one I have. And it's been proven to me in this program that as I change, God reveals to me different things that have allowed me to come to believe in that God and that he's for me. But in the beginning, I didn't believe that was possible. I was born March the 28th, 1948, in Inglewood, California. And I say that to you because if you had a little baby girl on March the 28th, Easter Sunday, 1948, I'd really like to get to know you, and I'd like to meet you. And seeing as though I'm Swedish and Norwegian and I'm in Minnesota, I might have a really good chance. I was adopted into a loving and caring family 5 days later. They really, really wanted me in their family. And they were and are just fabulous, fabulous people. Everyone in my family drinks. I mean, it's just what we do. It was never a problem. It never looked like a problem to me. My whole family just drinks. To this day, if you smell like a combination of Rainier Ale, cigarette tobacco, and garlic, I want to crawl up into your lap and have you tell me a story, because that's how my grandfather smelled, and I just loved him to death. He was just absolute magic in my life. Now, the reason that I know that he drank a lot is because he'd have a cup of coffee in the morning and start drinking Rainier Ale. And that's just the way it was. And I never saw that it was a problem, but one of the things that's happened to me through these steps is I've been able to do inventories and I've realized some things. I realized where the first time was that I got that superior feeling, you know, of feeling better than. And it was better than my mom. And my grandfather was one of those guys that would say, "Why don't you jump on the sofa?" And I'd say, "What a great idea," you know. And I'd bling, bling, bling on a sofa in his house. And my mother would, I remember one day she careened around the corner, you know, and she said to me, "Stop jumping on that sofa." And my grandfather looked at her and he said, "This is my house. And in my house, she can do what she damn well pleases. Corinne, jump on the sofa. And Jean, you go get me another can of ale." And you know, I remember the look in my mama's face, that split second look when I was doing that inventory. And that look in her face was hurt and shame and anger. And you know, it wasn't too much longer. She went and got the can of ale, by the way. But it wasn't too much longer that she said, "Come on, let's go." And I remember that we did those kinds of things a lot. We would be there and all of a sudden we'd leave real fast. You know, and that's just what we did. My grandfather was really magic to me. He made me feel like I was a part of that family. And when I was around 7 years old, he died, and it was really a tragic death to me because he really made me feel like I was part of. And we went to visit my mom's sister in Louisiana, and well, I'll tell you, they really drink in Louisiana. I don't know, but woo, man, my uncle worked the oil rigs, and he was 7 days on and 7 days off, and he partied the 7 days that he was off, and we went back on vacation, and they were partying. And, you know, I was one of those kids that was in the room next to the living room. I don't know if it happens to you. I know it's happened to me in my life with my children and through the disease of alcoholism. But there's something about it. The kids go into the next room. You can have a really good fight because their ears must be sealed because they're in the next room, you know. Well, I was in the next room, and I was laying, going to sleep with my cousin in the same bed. And my mama and my aunt were to have a fight. And this fight was to change my life. It was to absolutely change my life. They started screaming and yelling as only you can when you're drinking and drunk and crazy. And then you got things like money, property, prestige, and death all wrapped up into it. And they started fighting over a portrait of my grandmother. And I was to hear the words that they were to say. And the one that stuck with me the very most was my aunt was to say to my mom, "She doesn't deserve that portrait. She is a bastard brat. She is not one of us. She never will be one of us. You know, that belongs to blood and it belongs to our family." I lay in bed with my cousin. Now, I knew that she must have heard the same thing because I heard it really loud and clear. And I was to do something that I was to do for the rest of my life. And today it's one of my character defects. I don't ask questions. I don't talk things over. I take them in, I stuff them down, and I try to figure it out. And what I took in and stuffed down and tried to figure out was for me to be able to be here with my family and to be with anybody, I was going to have to be perfect. And I was going to have to do things right. I was going to have to look good. So for the rest of my life, I spent looking good, doing things right, so I could fit in, so I could just be even with everybody else. There's only one small problem with that. You know where you're screwing up. And what I did is I stopped doing a lot of stuff. You know, I roller skated once or twice. I fell down. It hurt. It embarrassed me. I stopped roller skating. It was really simple. You know, I succeeded at water sports. I float excellently. I'm a really good floater. No, I like that. You couldn't get hurt in the water. So I really did a lot of water sports. In high school, I took a French class. My daddy wanted me to be a doctor. I took this French class. And the stupid French teacher, the whole 2 or 3 days, did nothing but speak French. I thought, how am I supposed to learn anything here? I don't even understand what this guy's talking about. So I dropped out of French. So much for being a doctor. Because I couldn't cross that barrier of having the courage to do something that was really tough. It was tough enough just being around. Now, like I said, we had lots of fun in my family. We went lots of places. We did lots of things. My dad was the kind of guy that you'd get in the car, and if it was less than 300 miles off the road, you know, he'd turn right and go look at that. You know, he just loved to drive. I got car sick, and he loved to drive. But I've seen a lot of wonderful things and got a lot of wonderful places, and I always got what I wanted. I was a surfer. I stopped swimming and started surfing, and I'm a real California surfer. I really did it. And I had this boyfriend, and he was just great. And we were like best friends. And we surfed and went together for a long time. And then I went to college. And the reason I went to college is I had made everything I'd ever worn. And, you know, my dad wanted me to go to college. And I was just kind of like out there, you know. And so my boyfriend's sister at the time was going to this school. And she was going to a university that was teaching her how to be a fashion designer. And I thought, sounds good to me. I can surf in the morning and make clothes in the afternoon. It couldn't be so tough. And that was my whole ambition as far as going to school. And that's what I did. And I got bored and started designing while I was still in college. And in college, I was to meet this guy that was just like my prince, my knight in shining armor. And he was from another country. And the things that happened were just devastating to me because I started losing myself through men and alcohol and drugs in college. Because I really thought that I could make somebody love me. And I couldn't make this guy love me, no matter what I did. He just cared for me as much as he cared for me, and that was the name of that tune. And my mama didn't raise me to be that kind of person. And when you do the things that I did, what ended up happening to me is I lost myself even more. And I didn't care about me anymore. I went one day with my girlfriend, Rhonda. She went to break up with her boyfriend. They had already broken up, but she went to break up with him. And we went to Hollywood, and I sat and drank hot vodka in his apartment. He was such a class act, he didn't even have ice cubes, you know. And I drank hot vodka, and I remember today why it was that he was breaking up with her. He wanted to be president of the United States, and he did not think she was first lady quality. And you have to remember, this is the 60s, you know, and I guess this was 1970. And so they fought and did all kinds of weird things, and so I decided that we'd go back to my house, and we were driving along Hollywood Boulevard, and at the corner of Hollywood and La Brea, I stopped my new car. I had a brand new car, and I looked over, and there was this cute kid in this VW van sitting next to me, toking on a joint. And he looked down at me, and I looked up at him, and he passed the joint out the window, and I took the joint, no big deal, put it in my mouth, rolled my electric windows off, and drove down the street, and my girlfriend Rhonda went ballistic, and the guy, they followed us in the van, and they pulled us over, and Rhonda's screaming, "Oh, I know they're narcs," and I'm like, "Oh, shut up, Rhonda." And at this point in time, I was going out with, like, really old men, you know, older, rich men. And he was such a cute little kid. And I gave him my phone number, and he was to call me for the next week, and I was not to answer the phone because I had some medical problems that night. I'd gone blind. Which, if you're, you know, like 22 years old and a fashion designer and as intense as I am, it was creating a small problem in my life. And I didn't really want to talk to this cute kid with a mutton chop. And he got real friendly with my sister, and by Friday, she was convinced that I should meet him and pass the phone to me, and I went out with him. And we went to a place, girls 18 or older to get in, guys 21, you know, sawdust on the floor, and they fill the wine bottles up, you know, with, well, they'd reuse them. They were unlabeled wine bottles. It was just a really class bar. And I had been going to only the finest clubs in Beverly Hills, and, you know, I was having a good time. And a week later, he asked me to marry him, and never did say yes. I just started planning the wedding. He didn't mean it, by the way. He wanted to get out of there and go see his girlfriend. And we've been married 23 years. You know, a lot of people I sponsor. God's got a plan. God absolutely has plans. I was a fashion designer, and he was a high-rise window washer. Our paths were not going to cross that often. I don't know why, but God had a plan. And, you know, I married him because I thought that he loved me more than I did him, and I thought that was really important. You know, and someplace, somewhere along the line, things distort in alcoholism. You know, it's a miracle to look around this room. All of the people here, all of us, love, have loved, do love, will love, continue with loving, an alcoholic, or are alcoholics. I mean, we're here. Those people are out there. Michael and I spent 10 years out there doing the dance of alcoholism, doing the twisted, distorted dance of alcoholism. My perceptions got so messed up with this disease that I lost myself, totally and completely lost who I was. I married this guy. We bought a house. Before we got married, we bought this house because I didn't want to live in an apartment building, and we thought it was a good idea. Michael and I have done a lot of things that we were like, well, that's a good idea, and we just kind of go do it. And it turns out to be a good idea, but we didn't, you know. We bought this house, and we had an earthquake right after we bought the house, and we got earthquake insurance. Always had that earthquake insurance. We're really grateful we have earthquake insurance now, boy, I'll tell you. He'd go to work, and he'd work at night or real early in the morning, and you know, I had a regular job designing. And sometimes I could look out my window at work and I could see him hanging off this big building. It was the biggest building in Los Angeles at that time. And I'd think, wow, you know, I went with him once up to the top of it and I watched him. And he used to, like, you know, they go over these things, you know, over this big building. And he'd stand on this little ledge and he'd push this basket out over the top. I only did that once, watching him stand on this ledge and put, he used to call him the human fly. But he'd leave some mornings. I remember one morning he left to go do a job, and he was so drunk that he was hitting the walls as he was walking down the hall. He was actually careening off the walls. And I remember what that did to me inside. It scared me to death. But if you, like I am, you can't ask questions, you don't make waves, so you just take it and you stuff it. And you cover your head a lot. You know, I do a lot of covering my head and pretending it's going to go away. And the anger and the fear start building up inside you, and you start getting a little bit more twisted and a little bit more twisted. I think the longest time Michael was ever sober when I was in labor with our first son. I was in labor 15 hours, and I didn't let him leave. And I think that's the longest sobriety he ever had. And I didn't even recognize that or know that. I didn't know that alcoholism was a problem. Everybody did it. Michael was my dad's best drinking buddy. You know, he smoked dope, and I said to him, that's socially unacceptable at my house, and he said, no problem. And he just switched from smoking dope to drinking vodka. It was a real easy transition on him, and it made me happy, and that was it. You know, when I married him, I figured I could fix him. You know, if I taught him how to dress right and how to eat right and how to go to good restaurants. I mean, he was real pliable, you know. He was the big piece, you know, potential. And I was just going to mold him into this thing. And, you know, and dressing was simple. I just threw out all his clothes and bought him new ones. And I didn't have a problem with that, and he didn't. And he was pretty easy about most things. But, you know, an alcoholic will only allow you to do what it is that they want you to do. And besides that, you couldn't do it if your life depended on it. So we danced that dance for a long time and got more twisted. Pretty soon, I was taking care of all the finances, and Michael had come to work at our family business, my dad's business, and his money was for partying, and my money was for the house, and pretty soon I lost respect for him because of the fear that I had and the hurt that I had inside. I had to do something with it, so I decided I should lose respect for him, and I stopped listening to him. He stopped having any good ideas. And I had all the good ideas. I knew best. I think that's one of the Al-Anon theme songs, you know, I know best. And if you only did it my way. And that's how I started living my life. One of the things that was to happen to us is I started traveling a lot. I went all over the world. And it was really great to go all over the world because I could get away from this. For a little while, I could be in a hotel and I didn't have to be in this disease of alcoholism. I got a little rest. I think that's one of the things that kept us together, is I got a little rest from time to time. And then I became a workaholic, and I was at home very little, because it was too painful to be at home. I had a housekeeper that took care of the baby. We had Mikey by this time. And, you know, I'm one of those moms that everything has to look good, has to look really good on the outside. My home was perfect. And inside me was fear and anger and frustration. I was so angry at Michael. But I couldn't lash out at him because Michael gets bigger in life. So I did what I know some of us do. I lashed out at the kids because the kids stay stale. They can't go anyplace. They can't do anything. They have your and you know, they're just there. And so when I get really angry and start to lose it, I would lose it at Mikey. You know, and I would yell and I would scream at him because I didn't know what else to do. One time, he did something, and he talked about this. My son talked about this when he talked. He was to do something. He got me so mad, I took his Dino dog, and I put it in the trash compactor, and I compacted his Dino dog. And that poor little thing went and grabbed it out of the trash compactor. I was crazy. And I grabbed it back from him, and I trash compacted it again so it was just flat as hell, and took it outside and threw it in the trash. And then I realized what I had done and how much this kid was hurting. And I thought, oh, my God, what are you doing? You are crazy. So I went out and I washed Dino and tried to fluff him up. Lo and behold, was hanging over like this. Tried to give it back to him, but, you know, the scar was already done. Dino was done, and that was that. And when Mikey talked about it, I hadn't thought about that in years, and he talked about that, and I realized I was so crazy. But it was easier to strike back at him. And we just, you know, we had those times that were fun times, and then we had the times that were bad. I drank right along with Michael. My mother told me, if you want to keep your man, you go any place they go, you do anything they do, and that's what you do. It was good advice. I kept him. Almost killed me, but I kept him. I remember one time there was our friends were getting married and they were having a bachelor party and the guys got so drunk they couldn't figure out where to go and they called me to find out where the girly bars were. because I used to drive them. You know, Michael wants to go to Girly Bar, no problem, but I'm going to, you know. I didn't want to go to those places, but I did it, because you go any place, you do anything. We'd start having fights, you know. We'd have that fight for the keys on the way home. You know, and most of the time I was drunk, too. I really understand alcoholic arrogance, because I have it. I think I can do it better than he can, and we'd get in those fights, and we'd start driving home, and it's so weird. And if I won the key toss, he'd harangue me the entire way home in the car. And we'd hit the off-ramp at the freeway, and he'd pass out. And then I'd have this drunk on my hands to get him out of the car. Now, my mother also gave me another piece of advice. You never go to bed without your husband. If your husband is passed out drunk in the car, it becomes very difficult to get him out of the car and into bed and follow direction. And I'm really good at following direction. So I'd have to get him out of bed, out of the car, and we'd fight. And I'd get him out of the car, and I'd finally get him into bed, and you know, and he'd pass out again, and I'd, you know, need to let him know how bad I felt about what had happened. So I would, you know, in my pillow just a little bit to let him know how sorry I was that we had gotten in this fight and how terribly bad I felt about it, and I would hear nothing, and so I would, you know, in my pillow a little louder, and he wouldn't do anything. He'd just, you know, he'd snore a little bit, and so I, you know, and pretty soon I was in full blasted crying. I mean, I'm dying, I'm crying, and you know, and all night long I'm crying. He doesn't love me, he doesn't care about me. Oh my God, poor me. And I get a few minutes of sleep, and I get up, and I go to make coffee in the morning, and I'd be making the coffee, and all of a sudden these great big huge arms would come behind me, and he'd give me a hug, and he'd say, "Hi, honey, how are you?" Alcoholism is very confusing. You know, and I would process that in about 3 or 4 seconds. Phew, I'd process that. "Hi, honey, this is the guy that broke up the house, that did the this, and we got in this fight, and and I go through the whole thing, and I would do what I think any of us Al-Anons do. I think it's going to be different. It's okay. I didn't know anything about blackouts. Well, our life just kind of progressed and went downhill like that. We had a lot of fights. I loved jabbing Michael in the middle of the night when he was snoring to get revenge back. I found if I gave him a little tap, it was okay. If I gave him a really good tap, you know, he might fall out of bed and hit his head on the nightstand while I was hitting the floor. I loved that. I just loved it because I wanted to get back at him because I hurt so bad and I couldn't stand up to him. So we just kind of danced that dance for a while. Michael, I came home one day, and Michael was weird, and he went to find sobriety that week, and we checked him into a hospital. And when we got into that hospital, the doctor wanted to go to the psych ward, and it was full. So they sent him to an alcohol ward. And I remember he checked in, and I thought, alcohol ward, this is weird. You know, alcohol? Well, I know we drink, but we don't drink that bad. And I went to my first AA meeting Friday night. We checked him in Thursday, and Friday night we went to an AA meeting. And wow. Now, have you noticed, I have not gone to Al-Anon yet. I'm with him. I am stuck like glue to my husband because they're going to do it right in this hospital. So I go to this AA meeting with him, and I'm like a little mouse on the side, and I got to watch Alcoholics Anonymous work, and I got to watch one alcoholic talk to another alcoholic, and I watched my husband unfold, and I realized he was an alcoholic. I remember standing up and walking out of, it was in a little trailer, and walking out of the trailer and saying a prayer, which was my first prayer in this program. And I released Michael that day. I said, "God, I know he is sick. Please make him well. If we're supposed to be together, we'll be together." You know, I didn't know anything about programs. All I knew is that Michael was sick, and that prayer came to me. And I meant it with everything in my heart. And as I took the steps down, you know, off of that trailer ledge, I became myself, same controlling, manipulating, wacko person that I was. But I remember that prayer. and we entered into a life of AA and Al-Anon. A doctor in the group told me that I was getting quite angry in this family group thing at that point in time. There was no insurance, you know, for the loved ones, and I'm really grateful for that. We were in this family group at the hospital, and I said, hey, wait a minute, what about me? You know, I hurt too. Besides which, I'm paying the bills. I mean, I'm so arrogant. I'm paying the bills, and I'm still working, and he's in his damn green pajamas running around the hospital. And, you know, what is this? And this doctor had these piercing blue eyes, and he looked at me like, go to Al-Anon. I thought, oh, puke, go to Al-Anon. Okay, I'll go to Al-Anon. So, you know, that week, I went to Al-Anon, and I walked in there, and I really hated it. You guys were not up to my caliber. You wore polyester. I designed polyester. I just, you know, and then you did something to me. And what you did is you asked me to read Understanding Yourself. I was brand new, and I'm so grateful. They handed me the brochure, and they said, would you like to read this? And I was like, oh, great. And I read that. And I thought, who's been looking in my window? One of the things that I loved the most about that I'm really pissed about, is the fact that they took a line out of our writing. And the line that they took out, our conference people or whatever took out, was, and we became sick too. I'm so glad it was in there, because it helped me to understand that I was sick too. That I suffered from a disease called alcoholism. You know that alcohol can kill somebody that doesn't have it? Just as surely as it can for the person who ingests it. 4 months into the program, I was going to work every day, and I was, oh God. You know, we have literature in Al-Anon, and sometimes if you don't have a sponsor and you don't get proper instructions, you may not know what to do with the literature. Well, they have this little just for today thing, you know, that has all these little just for today things. Well, remember, I don't ask questions. So I took the just for today thing, and what I would do in the morning is I'd hit the parking lot at work, and I'd open up my one day at a time, and I'd read my one day at a time. And then I'd take the just for today, and I'd read every single one of them. And I'd get my mind set, okay, just for today. Every single one of them I was going to work on that day. I was going to be perfect. It was going to be wonderful. And I walked in that door, and I was going to be serene. And it was I just wore myself to a frazzle. Alcoholism is exhausting. I got here very tired. And at 4 months into the program, I was to do something. I would cry every morning going to work. I'd just cry, and then I'd go to work and read this stuff. And what I did was I turned left and went to the beach instead of going to work, because I couldn't do it anymore. I was dying. My body hurt. I was exhausted. I had to surrender, and I didn't know how to do that. I thought I had to work. I thought I had to hold it all together. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I turned myself into a psychiatrist and into Al-Anon, and I started working the steps. I fell apart. I had to give back the car and the money and the credit cards, and then I found out I was pregnant. And so now we're pregnant, and we have house payments, and the housekeeper had to go. That was terrible. That was the thing I hated giving up the most, was that housekeeper. Things didn't look so perfect at my house anymore. I had to clean it myself. And I had a lot of work to do, and God knew exactly what he was doing, because what I got to do was I got to find out about things that I never thought I could do. It takes 4 months to foreclose on a house. If you have enough food in the refrigerator for today, you got enough food for the rest of your life. Is the phone working? Yes. I love those simple questions sponsors ask me. Do you have a phone? Yes. Are you sitting in your house? Yes. Is there enough gas in the car to get to a meeting? Yes. I don't think you have a problem. I got myself a sponsor, and the kind of sponsor I had was a get in the car. I don't want to get in the car. I didn't ask you. Get in the car. And we went everywhere. We went everywhere. We did everything. And they used to say to me, "Are you having fun yet?" And I'd say, "No. Hate it. Keep coming back." And I worked the steps. And, you know, I don't believe that you can work on a marriage. I think you can just work on yourself. And I started getting busy, and I started, that's what my sponsor told me. She said, if you take care of you and you work on you and Michael works on him, your marriage will be whatever it's going to be. You're either going to be married or you're not going to be married. And that's what we did. And it worked really good for us. We had Toski, and that was a sweet thing to have him. And we just started walking down the AA Al-Anon trail, going to conferences. We learned that conferences were just as much a part of our recovery as chemotherapy would be to someone with cancer. So it didn't matter if you didn't have money. You just went to the conference anyhow. You made plans. You know, conference is coming up in February, and you know the conference comes up in February, and the flyers come out. You just fill the stuff out, and you send it in. And God's going to take care of what, you know, and that's what we did. The only time that I ever listened to Michael about that was Montreal, and he told us we couldn't afford it, and I believed him, so we didn't go. So I have a little resentment about that. But we just did those things. We just go and do and be together. It was really hard in new sobriety. I hated new sobriety because Michael and I had to learn how to talk to each other, and I don't know how to talk to him. And it hurt. I remember the very first time. You know how you have those clear memories? I remember the very first time that I told Michael I was sick too. He was whining and snorting about something and being bigger than life. And I was standing in the den of our old house. And I turned on my heels to him and I screamed at him from someplace inside, "Damn it, I'm sick too and I'm doing the best I can. Leave me alone." Because it hurts, this thing called alcoholism. And it's confusing, and if I try to talk to him about it, I get all screwed up. I have to talk to the people in Al-Anon about it, and I have to talk to other alcoholics about it, but I can't talk to Michael about it. I am too emotionally involved with him. So we began putting our lives back together and having a lot of fun in the program and going a lot of places. We moved into a new house, and we couldn't do that. We didn't have the money, but we did it anyway. And there came a point in time that one of the things was to happen that was another surrender in our marriage. Michael gets bigger than life. And the only person I talked to about that was my sponsor. I'm open with my sponsor, and she knew what was going on, and she was there with me and leaning on me a little bit about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And one day Michael was to shove me across the room, and I had an absolute part in it because my mouth was open and going. You know, I mean, I am not Snow White. And he was to shove me across the room, and I hit this chair, and, you know, there's a wonderful woman who died a few years ago that was at my meetings, and she said, "You'll know when you know. You don't need to plan it. You don't need to save for it. You don't need to set up what the script's going to be. So just know when you know. And when you know, you know. And you just do it." And my fanny hit that chair, and I knew. I wasn't going to live like that anymore. That wasn't going to happen in our home anymore. And I stood up and I called our kids and I said, "Get in the car." I don't know if you have kids like mine, they never listen to me. But my kids this day, they listened to me and they got in the car. I was amazed they got in the car. It must have been the tone of my voice. And I got in the car, and it was one of the scariest things I ever had to do, was get in that car. And Michael came out, and he was crying, and he was begging, "Don't leave," you know, and he was sitting in the doorway, and I had to get him out of the doorway of the car. I mean, one of those wonderful emotional deals, you know. And I said, "No, I have to leave. I'm not going to live like this anymore." And I closed the door, and I drove off, and that fear hits you. Where the heck am I going to go? My sponsor was out of town. I didn't know what to do. So I drove over to one of my grandbaby's houses. She was the closest one. And this sweet girl opened the door and saw her grandsponsor standing there, tears running down my eyes. And she said, "Oh my God, why'd you come to my house?" And I said, "Because I need you." And we just, you know, it doesn't matter who we are. You know, and my life was to change. I wasn't going to accept certain things, and Michael and I got back together, and I did do one thing. I narked on him. I called his sponsor, and and told him I was leaving. I just wanted him to know I was leaving. And he said, why? And I said, well, I'm leaving because of the fact that I'm not going to be, you know, pushed around anymore, and I'm not going to have this violence in our house. And his sponsor was to say something to me that made me really understand something. He said, how long has this been going on? And I thought, wait a minute. Michael's done stuff. Michael's done all this stuff. And you don't know that this is what goes on in our house. Secrets really keep us sick. Secrets really keep us sick. And his sponsor, I asked Michael about it later, and he said he never asked me about violent stuff. He just, you know, it was one of his withholds. And he got to work on that. So then we entered into marriage number two. You know, we got back together, and now we're going to do things differently, and we entered into marriage number two. And all the time this is going on, our kids are going to Alateen, and, you know, and I mean, our life is really full and good. My daddy got sick with stroke, and they closed the business about 7 years ago and kind of ripped his heart out, and he started going downhill real fast. And you know, I don't know, how long have I been talking? I don't even look at my watch. How much more time do I have? We might be here all day. She said, talk as long as you want. Well, let's see. But my dad started getting sick. And, you know, he, the strokes affected him. He's one of those people that had multiple strokes. And the strokes affected him in different ways. And a lot of times he'd lose his speech. I got to watch alcoholism progress in my father. I remember when I was a little girl, he'd only drink, you know, he'd have a couple of cocktails the night that was his night off. You know, that night he'd come home from work and he'd have a couple of cocktails. But the rest of the time we'd have iced tea. And, then it would progress that he'd have cocktails all the time. And pretty soon he was drinking all the time. And he'd just get really drunk. And when these strokes started happening, he'd get, and we were in program, it got really hard to be around him and to do those things and with them anymore, because they were always drunk and we didn't live that lifestyle anymore. And I loved them so much, but I just couldn't be there. So we'd go and I'd have breakfast with them. You guys taught me to do things like, you know, if you can't be around them when they're so drunk, why don't you start going and have breakfast? And that worked out good. We went to breakfast all the time and we did those kinds of things. He lost his speech. And he couldn't talk. He'd say red and he'd mean green. He'd say, and sometimes it would, I mean, his connectors just kind of went down. And I got to watch his eyes change and him start getting locked up inside himself and not have any way to express himself. We were in Seattle at the International. We went to the zoo and there was this great big gorilla that was at the zoo. And I looked at this gorilla and I started to cry inside. And I realized that that was my dad. He couldn't get, the gorilla had the same eyes my father did. He couldn't get out anything. He couldn't say what it was that he wanted to say, and I really wanted to talk with my dad. And then he'd get better, and I could talk and back and forth. And a little over a year ago, he had a bad stroke, and it was the last stroke. And they have this wonderful thing that they call a hospice program when we took Daddy home to die. And you know, I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and for these programs, because we took him back to his house. My mother's and dad's fear had always been that he'd have to go someplace else. And we took him home, and they had the hospital bed. And as a family, we took care of him. You guys taught me how to have dignity, and you also taught me how to allow other people to do what they need to do and to walk through the things that they need to. So my mom got to be my mom, and she got to do exactly what she needed to do for her. And my sister got to be my sister, and she got to do exactly what she needed to do. If she could go in the room, great. If she couldn't, you taught me to just be a servant. Michael, my husband, he told me later, he didn't know what to do. So he called his sponsor, and Bob told him to just be a servant, to treat it like a meeting. And anything that he could do for us, he'd just do it. And Michael knew how to do that. He knew how to be of service at his meetings. And so that's what he did. And he was there all the time. What I'm telling you about is I'm telling you about a man that I had lost total respect for. A life that had been so twisted by alcoholism and by this disease, and a family that could not function together. And Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Alateen allowed us to walk through that with love and dignity and caring. There's a point that I have in my life that I remember that is probably one of the sweetest pictures. We had taken, my father had gone into the room that was my room. We put his bed in there and we turned Mama's bed around so she could look at him across the hall. And it gets real tiring when you're taking care of somebody that's really sick. You know, you have to clean him, and we had to turn him all the time because he was totally paralyzed. And so I was laying in the bed with my mom, and I looked across the hall, and my husband, Michael, was sitting in the rocking chair holding my father's hand. And I could hear him say, "Phil, it's going to be okay. We love you, and it's going to be okay. You can let go." And I thought about all those times that I hated my husband, that I resented the fact that we were living the way we were living, that I was embarrassed and ashamed of the way I had treated my family. And I looked and I saw a miracle. I just saw that miracle. And I will always remember that miracle. Daddy died in a couple of days. And remember, I don't ask questions, I don't ask for anything. And it was February and it was raining. And that day, the rain had stopped and I didn't really see, there was no rain. And I asked God, I said, "God, you need to give me a vision. I need something to know that you're there and I can do this. I don't think I can do this, God." And I looked out the window and there was this rainbow. Now remember I told you my father used to like take a turn, you know, he'd like take a turn any place on a road. And he always used to say, "Follow the rainbow. Follow the rainbow, friend. Follow the rainbow. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow." And there was this rainbow. And there wasn't rain and there wasn't anything and there was this rainbow. And I had to check it out with my sponsor, but she agreed with me that that was a spiritual experience. And because I'm pretty dumb about those things. And I knew that we could make it through. And we went up back over to my dad's house, and my husband and I, my dad was in this position, a prenatal type of a position, and Michael looked at me, and I looked at him, and he said, "I think we should dress your daddy and straighten him out. What do you think?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." So we dressed Daddy, and we put some clothes on him, and I combed his hair, and Michael combed his hair, and they came to get him. And my father left his home with dignity. I don't know where that came from. That came from, I think, all of you, teaching us how to do the things that were right. And everybody came to support us, and we had just a really wonderful gathering. And you taught us how to allow people to share. And I got to hear about what a great guy my dad was, because he was wonderful. I don't know how to do it any other way. The day of my dad's funeral or his memorial service, I didn't think I could do it again. And I asked, and I got another rainbow. I got to the house, I opened a card, and this little card had a rainbow in it with a precious prayer. God continues to give me examples, and those examples have allowed me to come to believe. This year, when the earthquake hit, man, it was 4:30 in the morning, and all I knew is one second I was asleep, and the next second I was sitting up straight in my bed saying, "Dear God, dear God, dear God." That's the first thing I could say. As I just called out for God, "God, please, God, help us, God." And Michael's trying to get me to lay down so things won't hit me. And I said, you get Mikey, I'll get Tofton. And we jumped out of bed and we ran. And our oldest son was trapped in his bedroom. And Michael went into Vietnam attack mode, you know. And he pulled him out of that room, and that was really hard. You know, I heard a man calling from the other side of the house. It was not a little boy. It was a man, and it was my son, and he was scared, and he thought he was going to die. And that sound touched me. And I had to wake Tosca up. He slept through it. get out of bed. And we all got mated outside, and you know, Michael was naked. I was half clothed. The boys were all in different stages of not together. And we all joined together. I said, wait a second. We all joined together in a circle. And we held hands. And I said a prayer. And as I said that prayer, I looked up. In Los Angeles, we have a lot of lights. It is a big town. I looked up and it was dark. It was all the lights in LA had gone out. And it was like being on top of a mountain. The stars were so close, you could touch them. And it was warm. It was so magnificent. As we said this prayer and I looked up at these stars, I thought, it's going to be okay. Good will come out of this. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be okay. And we all broke, and Michael went to turn off things, and we lived through that. And now they're tearing our house apart. When she said my underwear was gone, I was working, and I looked out the window, and these workmen, Michael told these workmen, just take things different places, and then he had to leave, and he couldn't do it, and he couldn't tell them where to do it, and all of a sudden, I saw my underwear drawers going down the street to this container, you know, and I'm like, stop, don't move that one, bring this, I mean, it was unbelievable this weekend, you know, but they're redoing our whole house. Our house is empty. In February of this year, just really quickly, I came to believe again. Really came to believe. I had been working in a job that was absolutely unacceptable to me. I got this job 2 years ago, 3 years ago. We went on a vacation to Washington, D.C., and just before that, I had gone to make an amends to this old boss of mine for my part, and he asked me to go back to work for him. And and no one was hiring me. I was overqualified. You know, when you get to be my age and you've been doing what you do for so long, they have a really nice term for not wanting to pay you the money you're worth, and it's called you're overqualified. So I was getting a lot of those, and this guy asked me, and we really needed the money, and so I went back to work for him, and it was really went against my principles, the type of company this was, and the way they treated people and what they did, and I found that I couldn't talk to people in the program, and I couldn't do those things. So what ended up happening was I was to go to our regular conference, and at the conference I realized I was bankrupt. Spiritually, I was bankrupt. I hadn't been with you. I wasn't able to talk to you all the time. The job was asking too much of me, and I had to place spiritual before financial, and I quit the job. That next day, gave myself a Valentine's present, February 14th, and I resigned my position. And Michael stood behind me with that, and I started my own business. You know, and it's a miracle. My partner and my son are opening our business today. It's the first day of us doing business. I said to Eric, I said, I got to go talk. I got things to do. So you're going to have to figure it out. My sponsor tells me, God honors us. God honors us when we do His work. I have come to believe that. I've come to believe it because of y'all. I have fought the dragon, and I have won. Thank you so much for allowing me to share.